Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with Repack. Does your business use the three bin system? Learn more about your legal recycling obligations at repack.ie.
Now, in the Green Scene today, has that evil twin of the climate crisis, ocean acidification, already passed its critical point? But first, is dehorning rhino the best way to stop the poachers? I'm joined now by Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
So dehorning rhino, it seems like a cruel thing.
It does, but really that is the main reason why rhinos are still being hunted. And their populations have gone up and down in recent years. They've been decimated largely, and there's been a few attempts to reintroduce them and get populations to grow. But poaching really remains persistently high, particularly in countries like South Africa. And that's because dealers will pay tens of thousands of dollars for a rhino horn. They're very highly sought after in some Asian medicine.
And it's nonsense because it's only hair.
It's keratin. It's like the same substance that our nails and our hair is made out of, exactly. But last year, over 400 were killed. And you can imagine if you're trying to gradually grow a population, that's just heartbreaking. So this is new research that was published in the journal Science. And what they've done is they've looked at different methodologies to protect the rhino. And what they found was they studied the Kruger Park and other places. They found that removing horns reduced poaching by nearly 80% over a six-year period between 2017 and 2023. So what they do in Kruger is they sedate the animal, they give it a blindfold and earplugs, and they cut off the horn with a power saw. The horn will grow again, exactly like our nails and hair. So they have to do this about every 1.5 to 2 years. But really, there's very little risk to the animal. It doesn't hurt it.
So what does the rhino normally use its horn for? I mean, I presume the males would fight with each other.
Well, they do. And this is the hard bit of this. This is where it's a trade-off. I mean, they do use it to defend themselves. It's part of the social hierarchy, as you say, with males. You know, they might display a bit of dominance using their horn. But particularly the black rhino, and they do seem to suffer a little bit more from dehorning. They're a bit more of a sort of browser, a grazer. They might use it to sort of shuffle around in branches or in digging for water in the mud. And of course, mothers will use it to keep people away from their calves. But for conservationists, it is that trade-off. You know, how do they protect the animals and can they live without the horn? And I suppose they can.
Now, can they dehorn the rhinos in captivity, which are raised with a view to rewilding, and then let them out again?
They can. And again, sometimes that happens. And in fact, you know, there's one of the kind of good news stories about rhinos is that one of the big South African NGOs has now sort of acquired 2,000 rhinos. And this is an incredible number of rhinos. And they came about because there was a businessman in South Africa who thought that a novel way to deal with this issue of the trade in rhino horns would be to legally produce rhino horns. Because if you have a farm of rhinos, you can harvest their horns every couple of years and you could put those onto the market and maybe that would stop them being killed and poached. So it was sort of a good idea in principle. But he never managed to get the sort of international law change to allow a legal trade in rhino horns, because obviously it would be impossible to know
to
if they
distinguish
were
between
legal
the good stuff
illegal.
And the bad stuff.
So what he's done now is he's basically given all of these rhinos, they will now be reintroduced, although he does have a deal that he still gets the horns when they're removed. So he obviously lives in hope that he will still get to do something with them.
So there is some hope, but still it's a species that is threatened.
Oh, and this the southern rhino here, these 2,000, I mean, that represents about 15% of the whole population. But things like the Sumatran rhino, their populations are absolutely tiny. So there's still subspecies of rhino that are in absolutely critical conditions.
Now, we thought it had gone away, the talk about the acidification of the ocean, but it's been carrying on apace.
It has. So ocean acidification is one of these things that we talk about in terms of planetary boundaries. So these are 9 different measurements that scientists take about the Earth to see how well the planet is doing. And there's 9 of them. They include things like climate change, loss of biodiversity, how well is our ozone layer doing, how is our fresh water doing. And we thought that we had gone past the safe limit for 6 of them, but there were 3 that we were still within the sort of safe zone. And they were the number of sort of particulates in our air, the quality of our ozone layer, and how acidic our ocean was. But new research from the University of Plymouth has now shown that our ocean acidification has gone past the safe limit. And in fact, it passed it 5 years ago, that safe limit.
What causes acidification of the oceans?
So it's dissolving CO2 in the water, essentially. So that makes it more acidic. And the reason why it's such a big challenge is because there's many creatures in the ocean that use calcium to create their hard shells. So just mollusks and, of course, coral as well. They need to calcify, and that becomes much more difficult in a very acidic ocean. So, in fact, the measure that they use is if there's 20% less what we call aragonite. It's a form of calcium carbonate, which these sea creatures make. If there's 20% less of that in the ocean versus pre-industrial times, we say we've crossed the boundary. So these researchers, they're in Plymouth, but they also worked with NOAA, the US Oceanic Observation Organization, which has pretty much now been shut down. But they looked at ice cores and they looked at all sorts of different data from measurements around the globe. And they can see that, in fact, this level had dropped 5 years ago down much further.
So the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, obviously, when that happens, it's absorbed to a greater or lesser extent by the sea. But what else? I mean, I remember years ago talking about acidification of waters by trees, for example, and the water that would wash down from, say, Sitka spruce forests and things like that. Yeah. Is that still a problem?
That may be a factor, but the vast majority of this problem is caused by increasing levels of CO2. And that's really the call from the researchers here. The only thing that will stop this happening is if we have less CO2 in the atmosphere. And in fact, our oceans have already done an incredible job of absorbing a lot of the extra CO2. They've absorbed about 90% of the extra CO2 that we've added into the ocean. But of course, one of the things that's particularly concerning now is that a lot of this life is very deep in the ocean, and these researchers had measurements from as far down as 200 metres, and that what they found there, 60% of the world's deep oceans have crossed this threshold. And some of the very small marine life there, one of the things that's called a sea butterfly, it's actually a little snail, but these are the very bottom of the food web, particularly in polar regions where things like krill and then going all the way up to the whales feed on these.
So if you kill the bottom...
Exactly. And then we know we have that cycle where the carbon cycle in the ocean, which is driven by things like large mammals, and that brings carbon once they die back down to the ocean floor and locks it away for hundreds of years. So this is part of the whole issue.
So what's the solution? Because the CO2 is there.
The CO2 is there, and obviously that we need to focus on that. But I think, again, just a little spark of hope is the High Seas Treaty. And this was a UN treaty that was adopted 2 years ago. So the idea here was that the open ocean, the bit that sort of nobody owns, which represents about 60% of the ocean, that a large chunk of that, everyone would agree to protect that, leave that as a protected zone. Now, it was hailed 2 years ago, but then many, many countries did not ratify it. So even though they said it was great, they didn't sign it into law. But now we see 50 countries have signed up, and we only need 10 more when this will become law.
And what about the US?
The US has not, but Ireland is still on the list. So we're one of the countries that is going to ratify it now, hopefully, and we'll be one of the last 10 that's needed to
bring it.
But
given just the way the current administration walks away from everything that might help the environment, there's no real hope that they'll do it.
No, but I think if many other countries do, what it means is that we will have areas that are protected from deep sea fishing, from mining, and that will really help the ocean to recover. And of course, the more life in the ocean, the more carbon we will capture back into the ocean. So that will be a virtuous cycle.
Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland, thank you very much.
Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with Repack. Does your business use the 3-bin system? Learn more about your legal recycling obligations at repack.ie.